Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. My name is Dr. Miriam Nighan, and I will be your host on Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can tune in to us on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area, on HD Radio, and worldwide on www.irishradio.com. So whether you're here in New York City, or in Ireland, or somewhere else further afield, sit back and relax. For those of you who don't already know, Glucksman Ireland House is NYU's Centre for Irish and Irish American Studies. Inspired by the vision and philanthropy of Lewis L. Glucksman and Loretta Brennan Glucksman, Glucksman Ireland House NYU has evolved into a vibrant and world-renowned centre for the study of Ireland, Irish America, and the global Irish since its founding in 1993. We're coming to you today from our home, an elegant townhouse at Washington Mews and Fifth Avenue in New York City's Greenwich Village. Well, we've had another busy week here at Glucksman Ireland House. On top of our regular teaching in terms of our undergraduate and graduate classes, we've had a busy week of events also. On Thursday night, we had Dublin-born singer-songwriter Lisa Hannigan sing to a packed house as we collaborated with the American-Ireland Young Leaders, and it was a great night, and hopefully we'll have a chance to hear some of Lisa's singing talent here in a later program. We also had a busy night last night as the Blarney Star Concert Series restarted for the semester. Fiddler Rose Flanagan and flute player Laura Byrne charmed everyone, and we'd like to pay tribute to Don Mead's great work in organizing a fantastic lineup of Blarney Star concerts here for the semester. We're looking forward to another busy week next week. We're welcoming Professor Emmett O'Connor on Thursday night at 7 p.m., October 2nd. Professor O'Connor comes to us from the University of Ulster, and he will be discussing the Irish Labour leader, Big Jim Larkin, who was made famous by the 1913 Dublin lockout, and we'll have the opportunity to have a chat with Professor O'Connor, hopefully on next week's show. Some of you may know that in 1914, Big Jim Larkin embarked on a new role as a globe-trotting agitator, and would spend most of his next 9 years in New York making friends with radicals until he was deported at the instigation of J. Edgar Hoover. So we're really looking forward to that event. Professor O'Connor is coming to NYU for a major conference on labour history, and we're absolutely thrilled to have the opportunity to have him here at Glucksman Ireland House to speak about someone as interesting as Larkin. We're also getting ready for next weekend our Irish Film New York programming, curated by Niall McKay, who we had a chat to a couple of weeks ago. And we're going to hear a little trailer from one of the films that will screen at Irish Film New York. As we know, it's a retrospective on Jim Sheridan. If you're interested in attending this event, if you're interested in hearing Jim Sheridan talk and introduce In America here, next Saturday, October 4th at 7 p.m., and indeed the rest of the programming of Irish Film New York, the tickets are going fast. So get on the internet, look up Irish Film New York, look up Glucksman Ireland House NYU in your Google search engine, and get on and get tickets ASAP, because this event and the films, there's a lot of demand. So we'll have a listen to one of the trailers from Irish Film New York in a moment. What we've lined up for the rest of the program today is an eclectic mix of things. We're going to keep on the theme of film, Irish film, and history when we talk to Dave and Colin Farrell. Dave and Colin Farrell are going to tell us about the fantastically exciting project they've been working on in relation to 1916 and filming and collecting documentary evidence and information on 1916. When we talk to Dave and Colin, you'll hear a little bit more about that. And we're also going to take a dip into the archives. Over the last few weeks, I haven't had a chance to go back into our oral history collection as often as I'd like. And I thought this was a nice opportunity to dip our toe in again and have a listen to some of the nuggets that are housed at the Archives of Irish America in the Glucksman Ireland House Oral History Collection. We're going to listen to an excerpt of an interview with Sister Mary Virgilius Reedy of the Franciscan Sisters, who has spent her last years at Our Ladies of Angels Convent. I had the privilege of interviewing Sister Virgilius a few years ago. She was about 96 at the time. She passed away last December at age about 101. And she was born in 1913 in Ballymacelligot in County Kerry. And it's a fantastic insight into the social and economic history of Ireland at this point in time. And we're going to hear a little bit about her coming to the United States as well. Our interview with Sister Virgilius Reedy is a fascinating insight into the social history of Ireland in the 19-teens, 20s, and she talks then about her travels to Rome, where she pronounces her vows in 1934, and her arrival in the United States. As an educator, she would spend time serving in Brooklyn, New York, in Augusta and Savannah, Georgia, in Solvay, New York, Milton, Massachusetts, and Rockford, Illinois. She was very proud and pleased with her success of one former student, Chief Justice Clarence Thomas, who visited her many times and was present at her funeral. She had taught Chief Justice Clarence Thomas, I believe in Augusta, Georgia, when he was a child, and indeed he is supposed to have been very much inspired by her education and dedicates a lot of his success in life to the education he got from Sister Virgilius and her peers. So we'll have a listen to this fascinating insight on the life of this interesting woman. We're going to kick off though with a trailer from Irish Film New York, and this is from a film that was of great success and is an important reflection on the migrant experience. Take a listen.
We came to America because we had to get away from things. The Irish built Manhattan. So my dad says.
Is that our building?
You gonna live with kids in this building?
Is this a haunted house?
It's a magic house.
No monsters, no ghosts. No nightmares, no witches. No people coming into the kitchen, smashing the dishes.
Mom, Dad, Christy and Ariel, all together in one happy family.
After the night of the thunder, something changed.
Snake! Ah!
Snake! Go away!
Something's there. Look again, I dare you.
The kids went upstairs.
What's your name?
Mateo. What's yours?
Ariel. Hello.
How many children do you have?
Three.
Two.
We lost one. Look at me and tell me the truth.
Frankie, how'd your eyes, Johnny?
My neck pain. You don't play with them.
Who play with you?
Not like you used to.
So you're going to put your life on the line for the sake of the kids?
You know what the doctor said.
What does he know about us?
He's a miracle, Mateo.
What's wrong with me, Mateo?
We can't laugh. We can't cry. We take good thought and say it.
You don't believe.
To make believe you're happy, Johnny. Please, for the kids.
Everybody smile and say cheese.
Right.
Luck comes knocking on your door. You can't turn it away. It's a miracle, Sarah.
Are you crying?
Dad, they're going to shoot you!
Goodbye,
DJ. I suppose I'm going home.
Say goodbye to me.
Dad, can we stay here all day?
Mm-hmm.
There you go, folks, the trailer for In America, that award-winning film that Jim Sheridan will come and speak to us about on Saturday, October 4th. So do check out the details of Irish Film New York. We're collaborating with curator Niall McKay on this great annual event, so please check it out. On the topic of film, I'd like to discuss now A Terrible Beauty. This film offers a fresh approach to the 1916 Easter Rising in Dublin by using first-hand accounts to drive the narrative, telling the little-known stories of the ordinary people involved in the Rising. And I'm delighted to have two of the filmmakers involved in this project, Colin and Dave Farrell, here with us at Luxman Ireland House today. Welcome, gentlemen. And would you start off by telling us a little bit about the background to A Terrible Beauty?
The original idea was born in 2007, actually. It took us about 5 years to actually get it made. And myself and the director and writer, Keith Farrell, sat around a table and we wanted to tell a story from the ground up. So at that time, the Bureau of Military History records in Dublin were becoming available, and what we decided to do was to tell the story using the first-hand accounts of Irish volunteers who had given statements to the Bureau of Military History, civilians who had also given statements, and unusually British soldiers who had been involved in 1916. And Keith in particular, who's based in Manchester, managed to get access to the regimental records of the Sherwood Foresters and the South Staffordshire Regiments. So it kind of evolved from there, and then we moved from what was going to be a straight documentary to a docudrama, and it's ended up predominantly a drama, a 93-minute full feature-length docudrama with about 65 minutes of full drama and full action scenes. But it is told from three different perspectives, and it's told from a position of a lack of bias, if you like. We decided that it was really important to let the voices of those who had participated and survived drive the narrative. Finally, by 2012, which was 5 years later, we had managed to get it financed, and I have to pay tribute to T.J. Carher here, who kicked it off initially. Michal O'Malley, the commissioning editor there, is a very creative man. And we then got funding from the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland under the Sound and Vision Fund. And then the final part of the funding was a combination of a small amount of money from a distributor and the Section 481 tax break system that operates in Ireland for all film. So that's where it came from.
What, Dave, was the spark? Had you a lifelong interest in 1916, or was there something that happened in your life that made you want to make this type of film?
Well, the film was actually made by Tile Films, which is a sister company to the company that's promoting it, Tile Media. And Tile Films is noted for producing history documentaries and history docudramas. So that was clearly in our sights, even though it was 2007, that with 2014 or 2016 coming up, that we really had to do something on that. And the question was, what type of program? We settled on this idea of a film which was driven by a narrative which in turn was taken from the actual statements of those who had participated. So yes, the interest is there. I've certainly got a great interest in history. Keith, who happens to be my son as well, is a history grad himself. So it's a kind of a family interest, and the same with Colin. We're kind of three history heads, for want of a better word.
It seems like you've really done your homework on it. Colin, what was your role? You feature in the film?
I do, yeah. In the film I play, there's two brothers who fought around the forecourts in North King Street area, Frank and Jack Scholdice, and I play Frank Scholdice. In a film like this, you know, you're double, triple, quadruple jobbing, because the funding for a full drama, if you wanted to make a full drama like this, normally you'd have a lot more money than what we were working with. So everyone, and I have to pay massive credit to the whole crew, really pulled together because they felt it was important to kind of tell this story. But yeah, I play Frank Scholdice, who's a sniper on top of the Jemison Malthouse during that week. And it's quite interesting, actually. Frank Scholdice actually lived on my dad's road when he was growing up. Keith came to my dad one day and said, I have this really interesting story about these two brothers, the Scholdice brothers. And Dave said, hang on a minute, I mean, Scholdice is a very unusual name in Ireland. it has to be this guy, and it turns out that he grew up on the road where Frank Sholes lives. So it's strange then that, you know, me, his son, ends up playing this man that he used to see, you know, an ordinary guy cycling down the road. I worked in the arts department and stuff as well, but that's the nature of these productions. You got to just do what you have to do to get it made. I've worked on big budget things, American kind of The Tudors and stuff like that get shot in Dublin. But this is not that kind of thing. You just got to do whatever you want. And as a producer, Dave's the same. He's not getting coffee cups put into his hand as he stands there watching the action happen. He's getting brooms put in to help sweep up and that kind of thing. So it's very much a
hands-on project,
yeah.
So when you filmed it then in 2007, 2008, is it that long since it was filmed?
No, it actually, we got, as with most filmmakers, we got two or three rejections. We couldn't get it financed. We finally managed to put the finance in place in 2011, really. And then we filmed it in 2012. So we were in production and pre-production for about a year. So it took a full year to actually make it.
The idea came up around 2007 or 2008, but, you know, all these things kind of things, it takes quite a while before you get into the actual filming of it.
So Irish people in Ireland have had the opportunity to see it on TG Cahir, is that correct?
That's correct, yeah.
What was the response to it for people in Ireland?
The response was really good. It was repeated a second time during that week when it was screened. And I think it kind of, it's, people have grasped that this is different. It's not a glorification. It recognizes the heroism of the volunteers, men and women, who participated in 1916. It recognizes the idealism, but it's also, I think, an honest film in showing what effect conflict has on people. And also giving a voice to the British soldier who found themselves in a place that they shouldn't have been. These soldiers couldn't have contemplated fighting in Dublin. It was kind of an impossible thought for them. But that's where they found themselves, and that's where many of them died.
I mean, we try to deal with the complexities of the issue. It's never as simple as people like to think sometimes, and I think now, almost 100 years later, there's a great willingness to actually see the story for what it is, as opposed to maybe the preconceived notions that people have. I think people are willing to hear all sides now, as opposed to just the volunteer element.
Now, one of the things that really excites us here at Luxman Ireland House at NYU is to see that a follow-on project is coming out of this. So, A Terrible Beauty, 1916 to 2016. Can you tell me a little bit about that? And perhaps there are people here listening to the show who might be specifically interested in what's involved.
The first time we showed this film was in 2013 at the Jemison Dublin International Film Festival, but it didn't actually show on Irish TV until Easter Monday of this year. So our main focus kind of from the start of the year till then was to try and promote the screenings we have and promote those two dates that went out on TG Cahir. And as we started doing that, we started finding all these kind of other stories. We very much focus on the film on the ordinary story, the ordinary person. This project has grown very much out of that organically. We didn't really set out to kind of tell all these series of stories that we're doing now. People started coming to us after seeing the film and saying, hey, you know, I have a story, my family has a story, like the Walsh brothers who fought in Clanwilliam House. We only have a certain amount of time, in an hour and a half, to tell a few different stories, personal stories, but there are so many others in that week that we want to try and get out there now. So this project is a great way to do this. As we started doing it, we realised just how important it was to talk to the families and let them have a voice, let them tell their story, because otherwise it wouldn't be known. And then there's a great interest in the personal stories from the general public that want to hear more about 1916.
Specifically, Colin, then here in a place like New York, where there must be descendants of people who were involved in 1916.
Exactly, and we really want to put out a call to people in New York and in the States in general for stories of... There's quite a few men who ended up going over to the States, and most of them actually came here to New York. So we really want to put out a call to everyone who's listening, if they know a story or if there's something that they can share, whether it's a family, a friend. Go to our website, 1916film.com, and you can engage with us there. There is a form where you can put in your details and kind of tell us a little bit about what your story is. And we'll get back to everyone who does that and start a conversation, primarily to start with over email back and forth. And then we'd love to then meet up with family members if they're willing to tell the story and want to get it out to the general public. You know, there's an education element to it.
Absolutely. And Colin, for us here at Duxbury Ireland House NYU, the Archives of Irish America is a very important part of our remit here in documenting the experience of the Irish in the United States. Hopefully there will be some room for collaboration in terms of possibly feeding some of those stories into the archives, so that historical legacy. I really feel strongly that at this moment, and you've kind of mentioned it earlier, we're 100 years on, Ireland has changed a lot. Things aren't sometimes always as perfect as we envision that they might be, sure. But we're all living on the island, and on many levels, by most barometers, people have a fairly good standard of living in Ireland, and we've a lot to be grateful for, which I know we forget at times. And this is a great opportunity to really push out the boat in terms of capturing that lived experience and the experience of descendants of 1916.
Well, in a way, we've kind of been floored by the screenings that we have done. We premiered the film in Philadelphia just, it seems like a long time ago, but it's only a little over a week ago. And then we went down to Pittsburgh, Boston, and then New York here. And then finally we'll return to Chicago in another 10 days' time. But the reaction has been phenomenal, both from the point of view of an understanding of the film itself and the balance that's there in regard to the way in which 1916 has been treated. And more significantly, that people want to hear more. They want to hear about the American story. Mm. And they want us to engage. And we've already, through Cormac O'Malley, got one story which is covered in the film but is incomplete.
Mm-hmm.
And the other reason why we've gone this route, which wasn't where we set out from, was the people who participated are not people whose lives started and finished on Easter Monday and finished on Easter Saturday. They had lives before and they have lives since. And that's why we've tagged the project A Living History, 1916 to 2016. But yeah, for us, the American part of this story is really important. And the level of support, American support, particularly through Clanna Gael, was huge. It was significant. So we're really excited. We're kind of a bit overwhelmed, but we're really excited by the prospect of what's ahead for us over the next couple of years.
Well, I'd like to take this opportunity to urge anyone who has an interest to go to your website again, is 1916film.com,
That's
Colin?
Correct, yeah.
Or to email us here at ireland.house@nyu.edu. It's a meeting of minds here in terms of meeting the Farrells and seeing the great work you're doing, and to see how wonderfully you can convey it over film. And we're so excited, as people interested in oral history here, to hopefully collaborate with you. And I hope, at the very least, that this is the start of a number of conversations that we might be having between now and 2016, and indeed beyond. Thanks for taking time out of your busy schedule, guys. I know you've been doing a lot of travelling, and I hope you've enjoyed your time here in the US, and hopefully we'll see you again soon.
Thanks very much, Marian.
Thanks, Neil.
I mentioned earlier that we will dip into the Archives of Irish America's Glucksman Ireland House Oral History Collection by listening to the interview I conducted with Sister Virgilia Sreedy a few years ago. It sheds fascinating light on the social history of this era of the 19-teens and early 1920s. I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. Today is April 8th, 2009. And I'm here with Sister Virgilia Sreedy. So, Sister, would you mind telling me when and where you were born, and if you can tell me what you remember of your parents?
I was born in 1938.
When exactly? When's your birthday?
1913. And I was born in... well, I'm a country girl. So... and we lived in the country, and I went to the national school elementary school. I went to the national school
In Ballymacelligot.
In Ballymacelligot.
So, what townland were you from, or was your address Ballymacelligot at home?
What?
What was your address at home?
No, my address was Rattany. It was like a townland in Ballymacilligut.
Right.
Yeah.
So how far from Ballymacilligut was it, Rattany?
Rattany was like in the middle of Ballymacilligut.
Okay.
And it really was not on the Ballymacilligut. The direct road between Tralee and Castle Island.
Mm-hmm.
But Ballymacilligut was not on the direct. Ballymacilligut, that's where Ballymacilligut was. But where I was born in Rattany was like off the beaten track.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And were your parents from near around there?
My father was from there and my mother was from there. And my father died. I was only 7 weeks old when my father died. I was the youngest of 10.
And how did he die?
Well, you know, in 1913, there was very, very little medication or something like pneumonia or something like that.
Oh, my God.
You know, it was a thing that was never talked of.
Right.
You know how they are at home?
And tell me this, so when exactly when's your birthday?
My birthday is 6th of September.
Okay, so you were born the 6th of September, 1913.
And this coming September, please God, I'll be 96.
My God. So tell
me. My mother lived until she was 93.
Well. And tell me, what was your father's name?
My father was... You know, the funny thing, my father was Tom Reedy and my mother was Mary Reedy, both of both of the same R-E-I-D-Y, but no way related.
Really? So, Mary Reedy married Tom
that
Reedy.
That was my mother's name.
Right.
And my father's name was Tom Reedy.
Right.
And he was only 45 when he died. And my mother lived, she was 53. Until she was 60, she was,
93, did you say?
No, she was in her late 90s. Let me see now, is it 96 or 93? She was 96 when she died, my mother.
Wow.
And she raised 10 of us. I was the youngest.
So, what did your father do for a living before he died?
He was a tailor.
Oh.
And he died at 45.
So how did you survive when he died? How did you...
Well, my father's family on my father's side were very, very, very mindful of... there were 10 of us there. Were very mindful of of our family. And so was on my mother's side. They were both Reedies on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
They were both very mindful of us, like... My brothers particularly lived much of the year like at either side of the family. My father's side of the family and my mother's side of the family were very, very kind and mindful of the situation where there were 10 children and no father.
Mm-hmm.
So for that way, we were very well provided for.
So did you went to the local school?
I went to the local school until I was finished in the 7th grade. That was as far as where the local school went, Clohern Local School. The church and the school were about a mile away from where my mother lived.
So what did you do next when you finished there?
I didn't finish. When I finished in the local school, I went to the Sisters of Mercy in Mudderwell in Tralee. Mudderwell was the name of the school in Tralee. Evidently, the building is not there any longer.
Right.
So you went in there to school, or?
I
cycled in every morning and every afternoon. I cycled home. During the winter time, I might stay. There was a relative that I might stay, if it was, the weather was bad, I might stay overnight there. But I did not, because my mother was, I was the youngest and I was the last one.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like the last one at home.
And tell me, did any of your brothers or sisters emigrate?
Yes. My oldest brother, Jack, God rest his soul, he was shot by the 10th. Major McKinnon was shot in Tralee around the 15th of April. And his last words were, "Burden Bell McKerrigan." So, the Tens went immediately out for Bell McKerrigan. And my brother was a tailor, and he was working with my uncle, who was a tailor. And the word was spread that the Tens were coming, and they ran for the hills. And unfortunately, the hills were the wrong place to run for, because they were too conspicuous. And that's where my brother John was. Jack was shot by the Tens.
So you remember that vividly?
I was 7 years old. I remember it very well. And like, he was shot in the afternoon about 2 o'clock. And at 7 o'clock that night, I remember the soldiers bringing the lorry, and the body was in the back of the lorry, and they came up what we used to call the upper road, you know, it was not a main road, and they stopped at the house and came in and brought my mother out to identify the body. And I remember that so well.
And did you know at that point that he had been killed?
Pardon?
Had you heard the news that he'd been killed before?
Yes, we heard the news that he'd been killed, and for that reason, my mother was waiting for the body to be brought in, you know, for her to identify it. She was expecting it.
Was she in an awful way?
Well, naturally, she was. She was very upset. He was the oldest of the boys of the family, and he had taken on tailoring, and he was working with my uncle, who was a tailor. And when they heard that the Tens were coming, they ran for the hills.
Yeah.
And of course, it was an easy target then.
And Why did the general say go for Ballymacallaghan? Did he know?
He said Burden Ballymacallaghan.
Why Ballymacallaghan?
Ballymacallaghan was a rebel area.
Right.
It was real rebel territory.
And was your brother involved in, like, was he in the IRA and stuff? The brother who was killed, Jack?
My brother that was killed. And he was the oldest. And the other brother, I had another brother, Pat. And he was involved in the, you know, the all the young fellows were involved at home at that time against the British. So, I don't know where my brother Pat was. I have no idea of that. But he was the next one. I had two sisters that were older in the family, and then I had my brother Jack and my brother Pat. When the whole thing was over in 1923, my brother Pat came out to California to my aunt and stay there for the rest of his life. Of course, he went back periodically to visit Ireland.
Mm-hmm. And tell me this, was there anybody else killed that day?
No, the other fellow, the other young man that was a tailor also, and he was working, they were both working with my uncle, and he ran too, but he escaped. He was fortunate enough that he escaped. He was not shot.
So was your brother Jack living at home? And
he was living at home.
So what happened then? So what happened then? Can you remember what happened after your mother identified the body?
They took it away. They took the body away. And that was Friday night. And Saturday they gave over the body on Saturday. They took it into Tralee. And Saturday the body was given over. And Saturday, and then on Sunday, their body was brought out, and he was buried in our local graveyard out in the up at what we used to call Caves of Crag. And that was it.
Do you remember the funeral?
Yeah.
So, and I suppose it must have been a massive funeral, was it?
Well, you see, not all the people, like the farmers, were anti-British. A lot of them were pro-British. So, for that reason, you know, if you were a wealthy farmer, why would these scamps be... making a nuisance for themselves and for everybody else around the country? Why don't they go to work and behave themselves? That was the attitude of people like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not everybody in Ireland at that time was anti-British.
Mm. So it must have been an unbelievable trauma for you to watch as a 7-year-old.
Yes, because I was the last one to see him in the afternoon where the national school was. The kindergarten, the infants, because I was 7 years of age, and the infants were let out at 1 o'clock. So I couldn't come home alone, so I had to, I was standing out in the yard, and I was the last one that saw my brother Jack. I saw him pass by going to my Uncle Phil's to work in the afternoon. I was the last one that saw him alive.
And what age was he when he was killed?
In
his 20s?
He must have been about in his early 20s.
Right. Did your mother ever get over it?
Never. Never.
God. And so then he was, I mean, and as well, I mean, the fact that he lived at home as well then, you know.
Pardon?
I mean, the fact that he lived at home still and everything, I mean, you must have missed him a lot.
And my mother had a most gorgeous and beautiful framed picture of him, you know, because he was a very good-looking fella. And I remember when the Free Staters came, then later on, I remember the Free Staters coming and searching the houses, you know, after when we had the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember my mother saying to them, they were searching the house, and up in the parlor she had this gorgeous... A photograph of Jack framed, and she said, and you would have the nerve to search the house, she said, and my dead son looking down on you. Of course, they wouldn't dare turn around and shoot her.
So do you remember a lot of the events around that time, sister? Do you remember a lot of the events around that time?
All that, you could never forget.
Yeah.
That you could never forget.
Do you remember the Black and Tans being around?
I remember the Black and Tans, and I remember the Free Staters.
And what would the Black and Tans do?
They were the British soldiers. The Free Staters were the... There was the division between the Irish themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't agree, which was not very, very not very strange, because they never agreed. But dare say that. Somebody else say that.
And so then the free staters had come in. That, like, what was there a lot of?
Well, they were the free staters were a couple of years later.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, like, in your locality, then, did you knew who the free staters were?
Yes, because they were all Irish guys.
Yeah, they were local fellas, basically.
No, they were no. There were no British soldiers in the Free Staters.
Yeah, it was the Irish.
They were the Irish fighting the Irish.
Yeah.
Which is not very, very strange. They're still doing it.
So, was there a lot of bad feeling, so, between the people, the Free Staters,
well,
and the others?
Well, if you were a farmer, you were on the British side. You were pro-British if you were a farmer, because that was the means of livelihood. And why should people like us, we were poor. Why should these poor scamps? Why couldn't they behave themselves at work?
Mm-hmm.
That was the attitude there.
Do you think that part of the reason that Pat left Ireland and came out to California was to get away from us?
There was nothing in Ireland for Pat.
Right.
And my aunt was living in San Francisco. She was out there before the turn of the century.
Right.
And she sent his fare to him. And then a couple of years later, he sent the fare for my brother Jimmy, and he went out to California to him, and the two of them lived in California for the rest of their lives. Went home periodically, but they still lived in California. When I finished the seventh grade in the elementary school, I went to Tralee to the nuns.
For how?
And I stayed there until I met Mother Scholastica and Mother Brendan, who were two of our nuns. And, of course, immediately I saw the brown habit and the white cord and the veil. We had a round-top veil. Oh, I thought it was the most gorgeous outfit. And I must have been about 3 or 4 years in Waterwell when they came to the school, because one of them was from the same place where our principal was from, Rathmore in County Kerry.
Mm-hmm.
So she came to visit Sister Mary Anthony. Brendan was her name, Sister Mary Brendan. And that's how I met the Franciscans.
So you came home and said, I want to be a nun, did you?
Well, I was 18.
And what did your mother think when you announced it?
She gave me her blessing and said, yes, go.
Okay. So did you had done your leaving certificate, or had you done, like, a final exam in...
I didn't have done the leaving cert. That's the only thing I didn't have done.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So, So you're 18, so this is 1931.
Yeah, I was in my early 20s when I came to America. I came to America in 1934.
So where did you go in 1931?
I went to, first of all, we arrived in New York, and I went to Tenafly Street as it was. That's where we were taken to first, because the sisters that met us were from Tenafly. And they brought us to Tenafly. Then that September, I was sent to the section of Brooklyn called East New York. I was sent there. First of all, I was only 2 weeks in the country when I was taken to East New York to that same school. one of the second grade teacher was getting married, so I was in school for 2 weeks before the school closed.
Oh my God. But Kabir, sister, when you went into the Franciscan order first in 1931, did you come straight to America?
No.
Where did you go first?
We were taken to Rome.
Okay.
And I made my novitiate in Rome. I was in Rome for 3 years.
Did you like Rome? Tell me about that time being there.
Of course, we didn't do any better.
What was it like in Rome in the late 20s and early 30s? What was the city like?
As I say, we didn't know any better, so it was great to us.
Right.
Because Scholastica was great for taking us out. She knew it was an opportunity we never would get if we went to Rome, and it was an opportunity we would never get again. So she made every possible, she made every move that she possibly could to let us get every possible, advantage while we were in Rome.
Mm-hmm. So you went to see all the tourist sites?
The Mother House was in Rome, and we were there from 1931 to 1934. And I came to America, and I came to Tenerife, that was the first in 1934.
So when you went into the Holy Orders in 1931, so you went from Tralee to Rome, was it? Or where did you enter?
We went from Ireland. There were 21 of us, 21 girls from all over Ireland.
Really?
And we went to Rome.
21 of you.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And there was one there in Rome when we got there. She was from Egypt. She joined our gang.
Oh my God. So you end up anyway in, do you remember the journey from Italy to America?
Yes, we came on the Côte di Savoie.
The what?
The Côte di Savoie.
Okay.
That was the name of the Italian boat.
And how long did it take you to come over?
About 7 days.
And did you have to come through Ellis Island when you arrived?
No, Ellis Island was not in the picture.
Okay.
We didn't come through Ellis Island. We came through New York all right, because the two sisters that met us were from Tenerife. That's why we were brought to Tenerife.
Oh, I was asking you about East New York. I'm just interested to know, you were saying it was mainly Italian people living there?
The parents, most of them were completely from Italy.
Right.
And they were very anxious that they, of course, they were the first generation of Italians to come to America, and they were very anxious to get their children educated in America.
Mm-hmm.
Because St. John's University was very important in Brooklyn at that time. It still is very important.
Mm-hmm.
But so many of the Italians of first generation, you had a lot of them that graduated from St. John's University.
Right.
So their parents were very anxious to get an education for their children.
Okay. Mm-hmm. But it was a predominantly, when you were there in that time between 1934 and 1952.
100% Italian.
So, and it was all pretty much a white neighborhood then.
It was all a white neighborhood.
Because I know later it became very black.
We didn't have one black child in the school.
Really?
No.
So you were 18 years there in East New York.
Yes, I was 18 years in East New York.
And then you were sent
We had what they call the Regents Exam. And at the end of the 8th grade, they had to go out to another school, which was called a center. And they took, at the end of the 8th grade, they took this special exam called the Regents. And, of course, every school was famous for their kids, all their kids passed the regents. You know how it was.
Mm-hmm.
So but they were good students, though. They were good students.
And were the teachers in the school there?
The teachers were some people like myself.
And were they all Irish?
All Irish.
Okay.
We didn't have anybody other than Irish in the convent I was in living in at that time.
So was there any kind of, not necessarily a problem or anything, but like, was there any difference of opinion, say, between all these Italian American kids and the Irish teachers, you know?
You forgot who we were, that kind of a way. There was no such thing as that you were Irish and you were teaching Italian kids, no way.
Okay.
That was buried.
Mm-hmm. When you finished then in Savannah, what was your next move?
When I was finished, I came back up to Brooklyn.
Oh, yes.
And I was in Regina Parches for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of that 2 years, I went down on my rank and went back to the classroom.
Mm-hmm. Why did you go down in your rank?
Huh?
Why did you go down in your rank?
Well, the community had a regulation that they had a general chapter that year. And they said at the general chapter, anybody that had been local superior for more than 15 years, get out.
Mm. So then you went back teaching in Brooklyn?
I went back to teaching in, I was 2 years superior in Brooklyn. And then after the 2 years, I was moved from Brooklyn. I went up to Boston or someplace like that. And that was it.
So did you completed your teaching career in Boston?
Then I went back into the classroom, and after that I went back into the classroom, and I was in I was 48 years in the classroom all the time anyway. Regardless, I was 48 years teaching.
So how long were you in Boston then?
Huh?
How long were you in Boston?
I was 5 years in St. Mary's a Hill, and I was that 2 years that I went up from the south. I was in Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
Then it was I was in different places. Like I was in Solvay for 5 years.
Where's that?
Solvay, New York.
Okay.
It's a village on the outskirts of Syracuse, which is an important city in northwest Syracuse, mm-hmm. in northwest New York.
Mm-hmm. So, and then from Syracuse you went to Boston, was it?
After the 2 years that I was in New York, any place I went, I was 5 years.
Okay.
I was 5 years teaching in that school.
And so, sister, in your career, you taught in quite different places, you know, East New York down to the South, then back up to here and up to Boston and things. I mean, was it the same everywhere? Are kids, were the children the same, you know, in terms of their needs?
I would say pretty much the same on the whole.
Right.
Yeah.
Did you enjoy your career?
Huh?
Or did you enjoy it?
I enjoyed teaching, but the last place I was teaching was Rockford, Illinois, and every place I'd been teaching before I retired, I was teaching in that place for 5 years,
mm-hmm.
and then after 5 years I quit.
So you retired from teaching?
Yeah, well, I retired in 82, I think I retired.
Mm-hmm.
Because, 82, I retired in 82.
When you left Ireland in 1931, do you remember when you made your first trip back there? When your first trip back to Ireland, your first vacation back to Ireland?
I went back to Ireland in 1947 with my brother and his wife from California.
And had it changed much?
Oh, yes, it had. My mother was still living.
Right.
Yeah, that was the best part of it. She was still living. And we went home. First, we couldn't go home at all. And then all these changes were made, and we were allowed to go home after every 10 years. And then after that, it came, and you could go home every 7 years. And then they started to bring it down and bring it down and bring it down. Now you can go home if your mother is sick.
Oh,
never mind dying.
So did you ever, sister, would you have ever preferred to have gone into an order that stayed in Ireland?
No.
Why?
Because I had a niece in the Mercies of Tralee.
Okay. You'd a niece in the...
No, I didn't. I had no desire to enter a convent in Ireland. You had to have a dowry in Ireland to enter a convent.
A dowry?
Yeah.
Oh.
£5,000, you know, so small thing.
Yeah. So, have you enjoyed your time in America? Have you enjoyed your time in America?
Very much so.
Do you consider yourself Irish or American or Irish American?
No, I'm Irish to the core.
Okay. So, what do you remember your first impressions of New York when you saw the city?
I remember I was only there a few days when I was brought to the convent in Our Lady of Loretta in Brooklyn. I was brought to that convent to fill in for the lay teacher that was getting married. And we were riding in the subway, and the sister said to me, "How do you like the subway?" Of course, I didn't know for Man in the Moon what the subway was.
What a nice place to finish, where we hear about Sister Virgilius taking her first ride on the subway. That, like many other insights on the experience of people coming to the United States, is just the tip of the iceberg of what we have in the collection of the Archives of Irish America's Glucksman Ireland House Oral History Collection. We're coming towards the end of the programme for another week, but I would like to mention an event that is coming up here on Tuesday, October 7th at 7 p.m. We will have Anne Cadwallader, the acclaimed British author and journalist and author of Lethal Allies, on campus for a presentation and book signing. She will be with Alan Brecknell of the Pat Finucane Centre for Human Rights and Truth Recovery to discuss Anne's book, Lethal Allies, about British collusion in the matter of Northern Ireland. That will be on October 7th, and I will give you more details on next week's programme. I'm Dr. Miriam Nyhan, and I want to thank you for listening to the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. I'll be back again next Saturday, same time, on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area and on HD Radio. In the meantime, if you'd like to get in touch with me or my co-producer, Jamie Sweeney, please email ireland.house@nyu.edu. If you'd like to hear this programme again, please go to irishradio.com. Stay tuned for the Adrian Flanley Show, which is up next on WVNJ 1160 AM. And for those of you listening on irishradio.com, you can stay with us here until noon. Have a lovely weekend. Slán agus fanacht.